Thanks very much, Patricia, and thanks very much, Cass, for that kind introduction, and thanks for the invitation to speak at the ACOS conference here today. I hope you have a very productive couple of days here. So I actually started life as a Labor economist. That's what I sort of did when I was at university, so I'm very much going back to that territory today. And I'm going to talk about jobs and wages, which is, as Cass said, something pretty close to what very much what ACOS cares about. I'm going to talk a bit about what's happened over the last few years. I'm going to talk about what we've seen in employment, who's got the jobs, what sort of jobs they've been, and then I'm going to also talk a bit about wages and where they've been going. Let me flip forward. So I'm going to talk about participation. So who's been getting the jobs, and particularly focus on two groups which have been very much have been getting a disproportionately or a unusually large share of the jobs, which is both females generally and then particularly older workers. Talk a bit about employment in terms of what the jobs we have seen over the last few years. Talk about wages and what's happening or not happening there. And then talk a bit about how we see things going over the next couple of years. So I hope that's of some interest to you. So let me start with employment. So over much of the past 3 years, employment has grown at an actually pretty healthy annual pace of 2.5%. So 2.5% extra jobs created per year for the last 3 years. And that's faster than we'd expected, particularly given that over particularly the recent past, employment growth was slower, economic growth was slower than we'd expected. Employment growth has also been faster than the working age population has been growing. And as a result, the share of the Australian population employed today is around its all-time high, which is a good thing. Normally, we would expect this strong employment growth to lead to a decline in the unemployment rate. But the unemployment rate has turned out to be very close to what we'd expected and has moved sideways around 5.25% for some time now. So what's going on here? We've had strong employment growth, but little change in the unemployment rate means that in labour economics terms, the strength in labour demand has been met by strong growth in labour supply. So this increase in labour supply has come from more people joining the labour force and from some of those with jobs putting off leaving the labour force. And these trends have been particularly pronounced for females aged between 25 and 54 and older workers of both sexes. The surprising strength in labour supply has in turn been one of the factors that has contributed to wages growth being slower than we'd thought. But at the same time, the lower growth in wages has probably contributed to some of that strength in employment growth. So what I want to do is look at the rise in participation rates of females and older workers and discuss some of the factors that have been contributing to it, talk about who's been getting the jobs, what sort of jobs have been created. And in doing so, what I'm going to do is make use of the micro data in the monthly labour force survey, which is when the ABS goes out and asks people what they're doing in the labour force, as well as micro data from the HILDA survey, which is a longitudinal study of the Australian populations. So what we're investing a fair amount of resources in at the moment at the bank is examining the micro data to try and better understand these macro trends in the labour market. And I said I'll look at wages growth and show that the lower average wage outcomes of the past few years have reflected the increased prevalence of wages growth in the twos right across the economy. And then I'll look forward and talk about our forecast for the labour market. And two of the critical influences on that forecast are how much further labour supply will increase from here, particularly amongst females and older workers, and also how entrenched are those wage outcomes at 2%. So an increase in the number of people in employment can be met either by an increase in people entering from outside the labour market or a decline in unemployment. Historically, more of the increase in employment has translated into a reduction in the unemployment rate than by a rise in the participation rate. So what I mean by that is when we have decent employment growth, mostly that leads to a reduction in the unemployment rate, and a little bit it encourages more people to enter the labour force. But the past couple of years have been unusual. The increase in employment has been disproportionately met by an increase in the number of people participating in the labour force. And as a result, the share of the population participating in the labour force is at a record high. And as I said, the two main groups contributing to this rise in participation are females and older workers. So let me start with females. So this is the participation rate by sex in Australia over a long period of time. And what you can see there is that steady rise in female participation over the last any number of years. And you can see right at the end there, over the last couple of years, it's kicked up again, where at the same time the participation rate of males has trended down and then has mostly gone sideways for much of the past decade. So the female participation rate is now at its highest rate, and the gap between female and male participation is now the narrowest it has ever been. You see similar trends to this across many other economies around the world. So changing societal norms and rising educational attainment have contributed to more women moving into paid employment or employment outside the home. Female participation has also been influenced by the increased flexibility of working time arrangements, the availability and costs of childcare, and policies such as parental leave. Nearly half of employed females work part-time, often to care for children. So the participation rate of mothers with dependent children has also trended higher, and it's risen by 10 percentage points since the early 2000s to 73%. So if I show you here, so the participation of, rate of mothers, and one thing you can see there on that bottom line is one of the largest rises in participation has been with mothers with children aged between 0 and 4. And there's a large amount of research, which you may well be familiar with, that suggests the cost and quality of childcare does have a significant effect on the labour supply of women, and that's a large part of what we're seeing there. Another factor that is linked to higher rates of female participation over recent decades is the increase in the level of mortgage debt of homeowners. So the rise in debt levels has broadly coincided with the increase in the participation rate of females, but it's not clear to establish which way causality is going here. So are debt levels higher because more households have two incomes and can afford to borrow more, or does the need to borrow more to afford housing drive the decision to participate more? Or is it the case, particularly in recent years, that the low level of income growth has meant that households have more debt than they thought they were going to have and need to work longer to pay it down? So research to establish causality between these things has usually found some evidence of a causal relationship running from higher debt levels to higher participation. That is, I've got more debt, so I'm going to have to work more. However, the analysis indicates the effects are not that large at an aggregate level. So the two significant drivers of the increase in participation rates of females aged between 25 and 54 over a long period of time are childcare costs and other financial factors. The open question is how much more the participation rate of this group will rise. So you can see there on the graph I've got there, the participation rate of mothers with children between zero and four is still considerably lower than those with school age children, but it's been on a fairly strong upward trend as mothers with children between 5 and 9. The question which we're trying to better understand is just how much further is this likely to go. So now let me turn to the increased participation of older workers. So the share of the Australian population aged between 15 and 65 has continued to decline and is expected to continue to decline. And that's due to the ongoing transition of baby boomers into retirement age. So the baby boomers are the big demographic bulge. There are more of them and less of us, less of me. Don't make assumptions about the rest of your age, but an ageing population will result in a fall in the supply of labour as those baby boomers age, but since the generation retiring is larger than the generation entering the workforce. But there has been a long-term trend for each cohort, so for each group by age, to participate more than previous cohorts did at the same age. So the baby boomers participate more than their parents, and younger baby boomers participate more in the labour market than older baby boomers. And that trend has accelerated recently and more than offset the effect of ageing on its own. So ageing population will generally see falling participation, but the increased engagement of these people with the workforce has more than offset that. And so what I'll show here is the participation rate by age and gender. And you can see the rise in participation rate of people between 55 and 64. You can also, there's another way of looking at the rise in participation rate of females, and particularly working females between 25 and 54, which I was talking about before. But on the far right, you can also see the rise in the participation rate of the baby boomers. And what you can see, particularly in that 55 to 64, is a very large increase in the participation rate of females. So the same macro factors are probably affecting males and females there, but you're seeing a very large increase in females, which is very much this point about engagement with the workforce. That age group has had a much larger engagement with the workforce throughout their working life, less so than their male of similar age, but nevertheless larger than the age group above them. And we're starting to see that feed through now. So why are older workers working longer? Well, one contributing factor is improved health. It's a good thing. People are working longer because they can, both because of their own health and also because the nature of work has changed over years towards services and away from manual work, which means most people are in less physically demanding jobs. It also used to be the case that many older workers would have to choose between working full-time and retiring. You either worked full-time or you didn't work. It was often an all-or-nothing decision. As the labour market has become more flexible over recent decades, older workers can reduce their hours but still participate in the labour market. So around one-third of workers aged 55 years and older are working part-time, with over half doing so because they want to, and because they prefer to work part-time than work longer hours. As people live longer, they may want to work longer voluntarily, depending on the value they get from working. But they may also need to work longer to achieve the necessary income to support the standard of living they would like in retirement. So if you know you're going to live longer, then it's a question of how much you want to spend that time living longer, working or being in retirement. But if you're in retirement, you need to fund your retirement. So clearly changes in pension ages are also likely to have contributed to this increased participation. And that's been documented in the past for females after the government increased the female pension age from 60 to 55 between 96 and 2013. Currently, the pension age is being raised to 67 years for both genders, a process that began in 2017. And in line with this, the average age of job leavers, so people retiring mostly, over the age of 55 has increased in recent years. So our analysis of the microdata provides evidence that the 2017 changes to the pension age has had an impact on workers' retirement decisions. But it's not all that much, but it's increased overall participation rate by around 0.1%. As we all know, one of the major considerations for those contemplating retirement is their wealth and ability to fund their retirement. So increasing house prices and share prices over much the last decade are probably likely to have reduced the participation of older individuals. So that's probably worked against this. So to draw this together, the participation story together, participation rates have risen as employment has grown over the past 3 years. That increase in supply has been unexpected. So it's important to understand what is driving it to have some sense on how much further these trends are likely to run. And as I've said, the two major shifts in participation have been amongst females aged 25 to 54 and older workers. These trends have been there for a while and have been even stronger recently. And in the paper which I put out, or the speech I put out, which is longer than what I'm talking to you now about, presents some more of the insights from our analysis of the various microdata sources to try and understand this, but there is still a lot more to understand, and we'll continue to focus on this given it's important to the economic outlook or the outlook for the labour market, which I'll come to shortly. So we've had strong employment growth over the last few years. What sort of jobs have been created in recent years? You often hear that the jobs that have been created in recent years are lower skilled or lower paid jobs. However, when we break down the occupation level data by skill type or pay level, it's not the case. So this is the pay side of things. So what you can see there is that the number of jobs created is about, at the lower end of the wage distribution, is about the same as it is at the top end of the wage distribution, but both employment growth larger than that middle third of the distribution. So this is going back to 2010. If I look over the past 3 years, where we've had this strong employment growth, it's roughly equal between the top, middle and bottom of the wage income distribution. So the growth in employment has been broadly distributed across the pay spectrum, in line with the existing jobs out there. It's also been the case that it's been reasonably evenly distributed across the skill spectrum, at least as the ABS defines skill. There's been about as many jobs created in high skill jobs as there have been in lower skill jobs. It's also the case that the number of jobs created in the private sector has far outnumbered the number of jobs created in the public sector, contrary to what you might often hear. Private sector job creation has been particularly strong in healthcare and education, which is partly, but a long way from entirely, due to government spending in these areas. But it's also been strong in business services and industries like construction and hospitality. So let me now turn to wages. So wages growth has declined noticeably since around 2012. And as wages growth has fallen, the distribution of wages growth has also become increasingly compressed. So this is where we get too much into statistics, so you can just ignore this if you don't like statistics. But the main thing I want you to focus on, so I've shown, this is what the outcome of what people got paid in a given year. So the top one is 2012, the middle one is 2018, and the bottom one is the difference between the two. So the main thing I want you to just look at is in 2018, there was a bunch of people who got paid 4% and more, and then in 2018, what's changed is there's a hell of a lot less people who got paid more than 4%, and most people basically get paid either 2 or 3, or they're on a wage freeze, although the number of people in a wage freeze is about the same in 2018 as it was in 2012. But the big change really is that a large chunk of the workforce out there at the moment gets paid between 2 and 3%, and not very many people get paid more than 3% anymore. So we've seen the main reason why we're seeing lower average wage growth is because there's just not that many people getting paid higher amounts and everyone's getting 2 to 3%. So it's a growing evidence to suggest that wage adjustments of 2 point something have become the norm in Australia rather than the 3 to 4% wage increase that were the norm prior to 2012. So we get this from looking at outcomes from enterprise bargaining arrangements, which very much are clumped on 2 to 3%. Similarly, when we look at this data, which comes from the ABS's wage price index, where again shows the large number of jobs which get paid 2 or 3%. And we get this from our own liaison with firms around the country, where the share of firms reporting wages growth between 2 and 3% has increased to more than half, which is the highest it's ever been. Whereas prior to 2012, it was less than 10%. So this data here tracks wage outcomes of individual jobs over time rather than tracking particular employees. It doesn't capture wage rises that come from getting promoted or changing firms, and that's the way you generally get the best wage rises. You either get promoted or you change companies. On average, a promotion leads to a 5% boost in hourly wages, and it's about the same if you switch firms. But what's going on is not many people are switching firms and not many people are getting promoted. So that's one. So the data I showed you a minute ago was what happens if you stay in the same job without getting promoted. This shows you that less people are getting promoted and less people are switching employers, and that's another reason why wage outcomes have been lower as well. So while wage increases in the twos have become common for many employees, those whose wages are set according to an award have generally been receiving wage increases above 2% in recent years, which reflects the Fair Work Commission adjustments, which have provided support to wages growth at the lower end of the skill distribution, given that's where a lot of the award jobs are. So wages growth for the least skilled jobs has outpaced all other skill groups since around 2013. So most people on awards have been getting 3%, whereas most people not on awards have been getting 2%. Let me just talk a little bit about how we see things going from here to finish off. So a couple of weeks ago, we put out our latest forecast for the labour market and wages growth. The economy is forecast to gradually increase over the next couple of years, which should result in a small decline in the unemployment rate from its current rate of 5.25%. So this is our forecast for the unemployment rate. That black line in the middle is at 5.25%, and it's heading down towards a bit below 5 over the next 18 months, 2 years or so. There's a lot of uncertainty around this, so that's what those coloured bits are. One of the key sources of uncertainty we have around at the moment is for the unemployment rate as well as wages growth is whether that big increase in labour supply we've seen in the last few years is going to continue. That is, we're expecting labour demand to still grow at a reasonable pace, but are we going to see the same large increase in labour supply that we've seen recently? Which means if we do, the unemployment rate really isn't going to come down. And how much further do some of those drivers of increased participation for older and female workers have to run? And that's a difficult question to answer and very much one of the key uncertainties around there. That's not only going to have an impact on the unemployment rate, but it's probably going to have an important bearing on wages growth as well as household income growth. And as a result, we expect wages growth to remain largely unchanged at that rate just above 2% over the next couple of years. Why don't we think wages growth will pick up? What we know from talking to the businesses we talk to around the country is that around 80% of businesses think that wages growth is going to remain where it is, and only around 10% anticipate stronger wages growth. That's as low as we've seen since we've been doing this, which is about 20 years now. And most of those firms expecting stable wage growth think the outcome is going to be 2 to 3%. So it really much reinforces the case that lower wage rises have become the new norm in the economy. The more wages growth is entrenched in the twos, the more likely it is that a sustained period of labour market tightness will be necessary to get us away from that. At the same time, though, I don't think there is much risk in the period ahead that wages growth is going to go any lower. So let me finish up. I'll try to give you a bit of an overview of the current state of play in the labour market and our expectation as to how it might evolve in the period ahead. And as I said, if you read the written remarks which accompanies this, it goes into this in a bit more detail. In particular, I've highlighted some of the key forces that have shaped those developments. In particular, the rise in the participation rate of female workers and older workers. So we're trying to understand what's been driving those macro developments, using some newly available micro data sources. And it's work we've started fairly, really devoted a lot more resources to in the recent past and continue to do so over the period ahead. So we need to understand that to help inform our outlook for the labour market. This increase in labour supply has meant that the strong employment outcome in recent years has not generated the pickup in wages growth that might otherwise have occurred. And at the same time, I've highlighted the increased prevalence of wages growth in the twos right across the economy. A gradual lift in wages growth would be a welcome development for the workforce and the economy, and it's also needed for inflation to be sustainably within the 2 to 3% target range. So Cass mentioned we have a couple of objectives. So one is full employment, the other is inflation objective, but ultimately what the Reserve Bank about is trying to improve the welfare of the Australian people. So let me finish there, and I think we're moving over to some questions.
We are. Thank you very much. Come on down. Thank you so much for your speech. Comprehensive, and I feel like I've learnt quite a lot. So now there are the questions. Lucky you. So what would it... I mean, you've explained the wages situation. It's something we've known of, but you've gone into detail. What would it take to lift wages?
So the bottom line is, what we think is it takes a lower unemployment rate than what we've got at the moment, and probably at least 0.5%, or probably down around 4.5%, and maybe when we'll get there, we'll turn out it'll be 4.5% unemployment rate, and maybe... when we get there, may turn out to be the case, it may be a bit lower, but there's a fairly large amount of uncertainty around that. So what do we need to get a lower unemployment rate? Well, we need continued strong employment growth, which requires the economy going along pretty well.
You mentioned in your speech that when you drill down into what jobs are being created, and you actually addressed what you described as a misconception, you said it's in the private sector. So given that, do you think there is more space for public sector job creation to address what you just said?
There's been more private sector jobs than public sector jobs. There's been a decent amount of public sector jobs too.
But so you think there's more space there?
Just to give you some context, so the public sector is around about a third of the economy. Private sector is about two-thirds. And again, the amount of jobs created has been about in that share, about two-thirds private, one-third public. So the public sector jobs have been created... and at least in the health and education, as I mentioned, there is some, so they're private sector jobs, but with some amount of government funding behind them. So it has been part of the story, public sector support, has been part of the story of the employment growth over the last few years.
Now, you know, obviously this conference is focused particularly on lower income Australians, welfare dependent Australians. That is the focus of ACOS and the work that they do. So under the conditions that you describe, how can policy settings be shifted, or what's needed to get those who are in entrenched unemployment into work? Because you've identified females and older workers as the driving this. How do you get those people stuck in entrenched unemployment into the labour force?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what I was showing earlier, most of those women and most of those old... So the older workers are mostly people who are already in employment, staying in employment longer. So they're not coming out of the unemployment.
They're just downsizing sometimes their jobs, right?
Yeah, and a lot of the increase in female employment has come from females moving from outside the labour force, working at home often, into the labour force. So also not generally coming from unemployment. So on the unemployment side of things... it's really an issue of having the opportunities for those unemployed workers, having the right skills and helping them actually find the jobs, which is obviously easy to say.
But do you feel like those settings are right at the moment? Because it seems that entrenched unemployment is a huge issue in this country.
So unemployment rate's been steady at around 5% for the last couple of years. The share of long-term unemployed in that has remained roughly constant. It hasn't gone up, but it hasn't gone down. It's lower than it used to be 3 or 4 years ago, but it's been going sideways, basically for the last couple of years. Some of the work we've done shows that... So when employment growth is stronger and overall demand is stronger, yes, that does help reduce the amount of long-term unemployed, but actually... To some extent, they're the last ones to benefit from that. It generally helps people who have been unemployed for shorter periods of time, and as I showed earlier, it often gets people to come in from outside the labour force. So on the long-term unemployed, it's very much an issue of the targeted assistance. Yes, an overall stronger economy is going to help those people in the end, but often they need, the evidence seems to show that they need a bit more than just a strong economic environment, they need some targeted assistance to help them benefit from that.
So that brings me to the elephant in the room, and you know this is going to go there, to Newstart and the rate of Newstart, because I think this is a key question. A lot of the questions have been asked in terms of the stimulus it will provide if there was a rise to the economy, and I'd like you to address that. But there's another question that I want you to address in relation to this. Mm-hmm. Would these long-term unemployed people benefit from an increase in Newstart to make them more job-ready?
So Newstart has been constant in real terms for about the last 5 or 6 years, at least, I think. 25, sorry, I had five in my head, but you're right. Two in front of that, thank
for
you.
For a long time.
I thought someone in the room would know the answer
Dr.
to that
Dr. DeBell, we'd agree, a very long time.
Yeah, so being constant in real terms for a very long time, as you say. As we asked this question a little while back, you know, as you said, often the context of stimulus, if those people got higher income, would they spend it? Probably yes. So stimulus.
And would it help? Would it benefit the economy?
So it's one of the options that the government has.
And Hang on a minute, you'll have your turn. How beneficial will it be for the economy if that were to happen?
In the end, as I said, is it a form of stimulus? Yes, the government's got it on the table. I think the other way you framed the question, rather than the stimulus question, is a degree to which assists those people getting employment. I think that's probably a useful way to frame it. As much as, you know, there are a number of things which out there which will provide stimulus to the economy. This is one of them. I think asking the question in terms of what is it that can help these people get into the workforce, and I think people in this room can probably answer that question better than I. But that's, I think, the right way. Well, not the right way. It's a useful way to think about the question.
So let's just, if I could get it really an open question to you. An increase in Newstart, I'm not asking you to quantify it, but would prepare some of these very long-term entrenched people better for work in terms of their ability to look suitable for work?
I don't know enough details about the exact nature of Newstart. I think that's, again, the important point to focus on. The issue, as you say, and as a lot of people here in this room, is what can you do to get these people most ready for work? Newstart is clearly one of the options around that.
Now, I am now going to open it up. I think I was allowed around 5 minutes. I think we took that. I've got so many more questions. Before I do open it up, I'm going to ask you a newsworthy question just on the resignation of the Westpac boss this morning. Okay. It's a huge story. You are the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank. I just would want your reaction to Brian Hartz's resignation and the revelations overnight of the sorts of things he was saying.
I'm not fully across the media this morning. Haven't been on a plane, but... so I can't and haven't actually read the article beyond what you told me about it a second ago. It's a serious allegation that AUSTRAC's got out there, and I think I have confidence in my fellow regulators in both AUSTRAC as well as ASIC and APRA that they're going to follow this through. But the allegations are clearly incredibly disturbing and serious, and I think that looks like to me the sort of response that you would expect given the nature of the allegations that are on the table. AUSTRAC and ASIC and APRA are clearly going to follow this through, of that I have no doubt, and do what's necessary.
Okay, I'll just leave it there, but I thought it was important to ask. Okay, questions from the floor, and I think there are many. Let's start down here.
Well, you can't see.
No, that's because we're in the limelight here.
Yes, I know.
Chance for the limelight. Yeah, hi. My name's Jared Thomas. I'm a friend of ACOS. Thanks for the presentation and nice to see you, Patricia. I found an illuminating article from Peter Martin talking about, Guy, your history and your passion for music and that you love... big fan of the Pixies, Velvet Underground, and Sex Pistols, and obviously The Clash. So you went up in my esteem quite a lot on that. So thank you for bringing me back to reality a bit. Look, my question, it's not a question, but how can you just not love statistics? However, for people who are living on Newstart, can people cover the essentials of food on Newstart? And do they have the resources that they need to look for work, given that 2/3 of people are on it for over a year? And in terms of the economic stimulus impacts, what is your view about the impact that would... Or whether it would target regions most affected by economic downturn or sluggish growth in the economy?
Yeah, thanks. Good question. So just by way of background, by the way, I used to have a radio show here in Sydney. In Canberra. I am in Canberra. When I was living in Canberra, I used to have a radio show on 2XX Community Radio.
You do have a broadcaster's voice. I did notice that.
Called Velvet Nights, which was based... very much inspired by the Velvet Underground. That's ancient history. But to your question, it's a good question. I'm going to rely on my friends at ACOS to be able to answer the first part of your question. I think they've got the best sense of assessing the ability of people to live on Newstart or not, as the case may be. To your point about stimulus, I think it's a good... And getting stimulus out to regional areas and... targeted assistance. I mean, I think that's the right way to frame it, is that stuff which is targeted tends to be more effective in addressing persistent problems like long-term unemployment. So one of the other things we've been talking a bit about recently, you may have heard, is around infrastructure spending and targeted infrastructure spending. So smaller projects, which... Thank you. I can actually see a bit better. Smaller programs which are out in the regions... Now we're back in the dark. But smaller... programs which are out in the regions where there are more problems with entrenched unemployment is also another option which is on the table. But I think, to your point, it's the targeted assistance directed at the long-term unemployed which is probably going to be most effective. Overall, stronger economy will eventually benefit everyone, but it tends to benefit the shorter-term unemployed more and faster. And it's really, if you're wanting to address long-term unemployed, you require targeted assistance. It's really the targeted assistance which generally seems to be the most effective, as going back to my sort of micro-labour days.
And just to follow up on that, I mean, we often hear the answer from the government, which is, you know, there are the jobs there for the unemployed people, move to the regions. But is that true? Fact check that, because that's constantly said in interviews where I interview politicians. Is it correct?
So there are there jobs out there at the moment? Yeah.
So these long-term unemployed people, if they want these jobs, are they just there for them waiting?
So the vacancy rate is actually pretty high at the moment. So there are jobs out there. You know, the issue, the long-standing one in the labour economic space, is how well-matched are the people to the jobs which are out there, and do they have the necessary skills?
So are they easy to obtain for these people, in your view?
Yeah. Well, at the moment, as I said, we have a fairly high vacancy rate, but we have the unemployment rate where it is. So there is a mismatch.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always a mismatch between people and jobs. But at the moment, we've got a decently large amount of vacancies, and the unemployment rate is higher than we think it can be. So that tells you there is a mismatch going on out there at the moment. The question is, how fast can you match it?
Hi, I'm Tony Wren from Anti-Poverty Week. One of the things we observed this year that was quite shocking is the amount of people who are actually working and are still in poverty. And we've seen a very high rate of underemployment in this country, which you didn't mention.
So we
get told by the government that the best form of welfare is a job, but already there are over 1 million people in Australia who want more work in addition to unemployed people. And already at least 4 out of 10 parents on Newstart are actually working. They just can't get enough work.
Yep.
So I'd like you to comment on, do you think underemployment is going to continue to grow as a phenomenon? And secondly, ANZ chief, not the chief economist, but an economist in early October actually said 97% of net job growth in the last year was public sector. And I'd like you to just maybe explain that to us.
So there are two ways of looking at the public sector one. And I go into more detail on that one in the printed version of what I said, but to answer that question directly, when you ask companies where the jobs are being created, you get a different picture than when you ask workers. And by and large, what the ABS thinks and what we think as well is that the companies know what sector they're in a bit better than the people are, because it's sometimes hard to work it out. And that's why you get the numbers I talked about, where, yes, there's been a decent amount of public sector jobs created, but there's been actually more created in the private sector. So to that point. To underemployment, I didn't talk about it today, but we have talked about it a reasonable amount recently. One of the issues which is going on here is there's a much larger increase in part-time employment. And what we see is that a decently large number of people who work part-time are comfortable with the hours that they want to work, but there's a larger share of people who want to work more hours. Generally, what they want to work, they don't want a full-time job. They generally want about an extra day or two. So they work on average working 2 days a week, and by and large, they want to work an extra day or two. So they want more hours. They don't necessarily want a... So it's not an issue of lack of full-time employment. It's an issue of not enough extra hours that they would like. So the other thing around underemployment is the gap between the underemployment rate and the unemployment rate hasn't moved that much for the last few years. It widened about 3 or 4 years ago now. So there was an increase in underemployment relative to unemployment, but going back a few years, hasn't actually moved too much over the last few years. But again, as you say, it's very much an issue that you know, there are a few ways you can obtain higher income. If you think about it, getting a wage rise of 3 or 4% rather than 2%, yes, that's going to help. But if you want to work double the amount of hours that you currently work, that's going to boost your income by even more than an extra percent or two rise in terms of wages. So, our job is objective. Is to make sure that the economy is as strong as it can possibly be to generate those extra hours of work, basically, for everyone out there. But you're right, to highlight the issue of underemployment, and is something which we spend a reasonable amount of time focusing on.
It's a question over here.
Peter Dwyer from Advocacy for Inclusion and the Canberra Regional Meeting of Quakers. Given that unemployment hasn't gone below 5% since the 70s, and if we don't spend spend the social capital, it ends up costing us a lot more at the bottom of the cliff in the health system. And as an economist from the 70s from ANU, I can see that raising the rate and also building more social housing has got to be the best way to solve those problems, especially with recidivists. There's this revolving door between recidivism and homelessness. 52% of people who go to jail end up back in jail because they've got nowhere to live. What do you think about that?
So I think one, I mean, I know ACOS is very strong on the social housing point. One thing I think I'd point to is a former colleague of mine, we used to work on the desk next to each other in, back in the day in Treasury. So John Koppel at the Productivity Commission has just, the Productivity Commission just put out a very interesting report around social housing, which I think it's very well worth a look at. But you're also very right to emphasise the, you know, the effects of unemployment are much longer than just the unemployment rate today. It creates a social environment which can persist for a long period of time, and it comes to the question back here earlier, is that it also tends to be clustered in particular regions of the country, and that also tends to create a, you know, as you highlight, the sort of that social network around that tends to very much reinforce, you know, reinforce that. And so it's a question of how you can go about addressing that, which I think you know, the targeted assistance point really comes to. So yes, an overall stronger environment helps, economic environment helps on that front, but if you want to get it, if you want to have the maximum impact on particular parts of the population, then it's going to be the targeted assistance which is going to get there, rather than, you know, a strong environment is absolutely helpful and that benefits everyone eventually, but it also needs to be combined with some targeted assistance as well.
This question down here.
Dr. DeBell, it's Matt Cranston from the Fin Review. Just two questions. One, because you've been talking about wages, I might ask, the narrative the RBA has been using to explain its interest rate decisions is basically the one where full employment rate gets to 4.5%, so on and so forth, you get inflation, wage inflation. That looks like it's not going to happen for many years, especially after your speech today showing, saying that. I just wonder, how strong is that narrative now? Is that broken, that narrative? Is that going to be hard to explain why you wouldn't get back to interest rates any other way? The second question, I just wanted to clarify something. This is in the statement of monetary policy last week. You said the board was mindful that rates were already very low and that each further cut brings closer to the point at which the policy options might, which other policy options might come into play. Those policy options, are they monetary policy options that you're talking about there, or fiscal?
I'll defer that one. You can ask that question, or you can get one of your colleagues to ask that question of the governor tonight, who's talking along those issues. So park that one.
That's a serious handball there.
Well, no, I told him I was going to do that. So, although I play AFL and he comes from New South Wales, so whether he can catch a handball is remains to be seen. But hospital pass is the New South Wales version of it,
right.
I think. So anyway, I'll park that one. You could ask Phil that one this evening. On your first question, I mean, it is what I was talking about today, and I did say that, you know, the open question is, we do seem to have wage outcomes of 2 to 3% are very much entrenched in the economy today. And does that, you know, the open question is that going to make it even harder to get the labour market sufficiently tight, get more people in jobs, lower unemployment rate to get that wage rises up? I don't think it's something to abandon, because we actually do see this happening elsewhere around the world. It's taken longer in a number of other countries to get there as well. But we've seen it in the US, in the UK, in Germany, even in Japan, that it took them a while to get there, but when their labour market unemployment rate did get sufficiently low, more people did get jobs, that they have actually seen wages growth pick up over the last few years. It's also, in the end, ultimately sort of fairly, you know, fundamental economics that, you know, I do think that in the end, when with, you know, demand and supply, if you run out of supply, then the price is probably going to go up. So when the demand exhausts supply, the price is going to go up. Not, I don't like talking about that in the labour market. It sounds a bit not very personal. But when a bunch, you know, most people who've got jobs, who want jobs, have got them, and there's still more opportunity out there, that's the sort of environment where you're more likely to see wage rises. I think, you know, that's been pretty well proven through history. I don't see any particular reason to give up on that at all. It just, as we've seen over the last few years in Australia, it's taken longer than we'd expected. We've actually had the strong employment growth, which is good. More people are getting jobs is good. What we haven't seen is a decline in the unemployment rate for the last 18 months, and as we were talking about earlier, particularly a decline in the long-term unemployment rate. But it is absolutely necessary to get that decline in unemployment to have that strong employment growth. So it's great that we've had it. What has been happening so far over the last few years has been more met by people staying in the workforce longer and by more females coming into the workforce. Both of those two things are good things. That is, both of those two things are boosting household household incomes. What it does mean, though, and what I sort of try to talk about today, is it's probably pushing, you know, it's making it even or slightly more challenging to achieve that reduction in unemployment and ultimately lead to higher wage growth across the economy.
I think we can fit in one more question.
Yeah.
Hi, Margaret Tipper from Westie. I'm interested, and I haven't read your paper, whether you'll be factoring in the use of, some of those women are underemployed because they actually leave employment to be carers for their grandchildren or kinship or other issues. And also whether you'll be factoring in a lot of Newstart and other benefit recipients also do a lot of volunteerism as well, and maybe that's someone else's job, but is it something that you'll factor in and look at?
So one thing we are looking at, which is related to what you... So the NDIS has obviously come in over the last while, and we're starting to see, some of the initial impact of that in terms of the impact that's had of people moving from unpaid employment or unpaid care to paid employment. And what that's happening both in terms of the people who are now providing that care, but also to the people who were previously doing that care. And I've just got one... There's one paragraph in my in the written version of this talk where we talk a bit about some of the preliminary evidence we see around NDIS, which very much gets is a start at getting to the answer to your question, and that is something we are very much focusing on trying to understand, because that's, you know, that's clearly going to be a pretty important development over, has been over the last year or so, and it's clearly going to be a pretty important development over the next few years in terms of understanding some of those outcomes in the labour market. So, yeah, very good question. It is, we've got a little bit of a go at trying to answer your question, but I admit a fairly preliminary go, but it is something we are trying to get a better handle on for sure.
We have to wrap up, but just a final question from me, because I can't help myself, as most people in this room know. Just, you've talked obviously about wages and essentially wages being stagnant and this being, wages growth being stagnant and this being an entrenched issue. One thing that is on the table, and the Treasurer has kept on the table, is the potential that tax cuts could be brought forward in the budget. Would that provide the sort of necessary stimulus in your view if that were to happen? Is that something that could be beneficial at this stage?
So I think what mostly this is all about is getting income, household income growth higher.
That's right.
So, so some part of that is through what's up on the screen, employment and wages, that gets household income growth higher. Tax cuts are another way of getting household income growth higher. So, you know, they're all, you know, I presume the government is looking at a number of options.
Right, that's right. But are you confident that that would be spent in the economy, or would it just pay down debt? Because with Newstart, you are confident it'll be spent straight away, right?
I think there's a, What we know is that different people have, you know, different, you know, willingness to spend extra income they get. People on Newstart are generally people who are going to spend most of it because they have to. I don't know enough, the Treasury I'm sure does, as to the likelihood that people spending tax cuts. I mean, one point about the spending, paying down your debt faster is that once, when people do that, they get to the point where they're happy to go back to, you know, spending how they used to. You know. But in the end, you know, as I said, what I think it mostly this boils down is to what can we do to get the income growth of households higher. That, you know, tax cuts are one way, jobs and wages certainly another.
But you are confident that with something like for you know, welfare payments, if they were to rise, that would be spent immediately in the economy?
I mean, most of the empirical evidence tells you that's what happens. As I said, it's, you know, the government's got a bunch of options on the table as to what they want to do to achieve their objectives. Those two are two of them.
Well, you aren't the Treasurer, you're the Deputy, Governor of the Reserve Bank, Dr. Guy DeBell. Thank you so much for coming here and addressing everyone.
Thanks.
And taking all of our questions. Thank you very much.
I'm Peter Davidson, Principal Advisor at ACOS, and I've just stepped onto the stage to again thank Guy DeBell, Deputy Governor of the RBA, and Patricia Cavallis, our wonderful journalist friend. Very important institution, the RBA, and I should mention that in addition to the well-being of the Australian people, another of its objectives is full employment, and that's a really important one. And we just had an excellent presentation on just that. As we approach the mid-year economic and fiscal outlook, we'll be looking to government to pull some budget policy strings, which will deliver a boost to jobs and incomes. No guessing what it is we have in mind. Raise the rate, investment in social housing, creates lots of jobs in construction, which are falling back at the moment. And thirdly, measures to improve energy efficiency in the houses in which people on low incomes live, because they're the people who are really struggling with energy bills right now, and that would provide an economic boost as well. Now, you will have received an exhibitor bingo card on arrival. To play exhibitor bingo, please visit each of the exhibition booths, not the casino next door, each of the exhibition booths at lunch and during afternoon tea, and have your card stamped. Completed cards can be returned to the registration desk and will draw a prize at the end of the day. Thank you. Time to eat.